It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the physical and mental hardship of migrant laborers toiling in Wisconsin fields, the efforts to organize around improved wages, humane living conditions, and respect for workers. That dates back over 50 years. Call in with a question. You can share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jesus Salas is author of a memoir called Obreros Unidos, The Roots and Legacy of the Farm Workers Movement. Jesus, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Your memoir begins with your family in South Texas, Crystal City, and you take us then to the fields of Wisconsin in 1950s Midwest. Why did you decide to begin your story there?
Well, actually, I'm a third generation migrant worker. My father and my mother had traveled to Wisconsin as migrants in the early 40s. My brother was born here in 1942. My uncle signed up for Selective Service several months after Pearl Harbor and served with the Wisconsin Red Arrow Division in the Pacific. But the war intervened and they returned to Texas, and we don't start again until, as you cite, the 50s, when our family is now six boys and my mom and dad.
Your grandfather taught your father the route to get to the Great Lakes. What route would your family take to travel to Wisconsin? What was that caravan like?
Well, my grandfather had crossed from the state of Coahuila, the bordering state, Texas, in 1906. Artesian water had been found, and they were looking for Mexican laborers to spread that resource throughout the floodplains, semi-arid but very fertile land. And he homesteaded there for several generations until the Great Depression, and that's when he was forced to leave the area and look for work in order to make a living. So he starts by going to the Texas counties, Gulf Coast counties first, then to the Panhandle, where large tracts of land were being put under cultivation. And if you've ever traveled...
Oh, I think we just...
Hello?
Hi. Okay, we just lost you momentarily there, Jesus. Go ahead on those travels.
Sorry.
Yes, no, that's okay.
Well, we if you've ever traveled from here to the borderlands, the point of Texas, and you get to the Panhandle, you're only halfway there. So from the Panhandle, he shows my father how to get first to the Plain States and then to Wisconsin, to the Great Lakes region.
Wow. And you mentioned this three-day, 1,500-mile caravan trip from Crystal City and then getting to Wisconsin and Hartford. What was that like for you to go on that trip over years as a young child?
Well, we were all huddled in the back of this 2.5-ton tandem truck, so with a canvas covered top. And all that I wanted to do most of all, because I wanted to see where we were traveling for these several days, was to see where we were going, because we were all covered, so that we children knew how to speak English and were learning how to read and write it, as new members of the caravan, or new members of the crew joined us, my father farmed us out. And because we could read maps, they assigned us to different people who had never made the trip before, and we guided them with maps at the stops where we stopped to fill up with gas. We would help them with the change and the purchasing of goods during the travel, that kind of thing. So that was the best thing that happened to me during those trips. At least I could see where I was going, and of course I was helping other crews or families that were coming into our crew that didn't know how to get here and couldn't read maps.
Because it was possible to get lost in those times.
Well, this is, if you recall, the interstate system is built in the 50s, mm-hmm. and there was just constant construction of the two-lane highways that permeated the landscape at that time, so that there were detours all over the place. So it was very important to get somebody to guide these new families that were coming in and to read the signs and to follow the roads and to stay within the caravan, yes.
Jesus Salas is a labor organizer and author of a memoir, Obreros Unidos, as we talk about the history of the first farm workers union in Wisconsin. You can join in with questions and comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jesus, migrant farm workers were organized into crews to do the agricultural work. What was the structure for your family's working crew?
Well, the since we worked with other crews, let's say, for instance, when we harvested cotton, the crews were segregated into the African-American crews and the Anglo crews and the Mexican crews. In the cucumbers, of course, there were crews from the Texas Valley, and we were from Crystal City. So the way we were set up is that the males and the fathers were uncles were on the outside of the crew. Then on the inside were the unmarried women, and then the younger children close to our mothers and our aunts. And so when I start writing about the working conditions, I speak of women because that's who I started to work. I started to work alongside them because I was one of the younger ones, and my older brothers were towards the end of the crew. Along with the single males and my father and uncles.
What was it like to weed sugar beets in Wisconsin and using a hoe?
Well, at that time, there wasn't a very extensive use of herbicides, so that we had to remove all of the noxious weeds and grasses from the plant and also space them. And since we were the work crews were family based, and it was about women and children working in the field, so our fathers would take the long holes and cut them to approximately 20 inches, so that because we didn't have the upper strength to be able to handle the long holes, they'd cut the small holes, these long holes into small ones. And then we would be hoeing, standing over the rows of sugar beets and swinging at the weeds to remove them from the plant. So it was very arduous work. It was backbreaking work because we were stooped over most of the day, and it was at the end of the day we could hardly even stand up or walk very straight.
You write about the mental toll migrant workers took on your mother and your aunt. How did the work affect their mental health? I think you used the word that the mental anguish of work was like a communicable disease.
Well, I've never seen my aunt and my mother in that state. And here we were working in the fields. Let's say, for instance, I think I was speaking when I was talking about them, we were in Henry, Illinois. We were harvesting asparagus. By the way, we wouldn't come directly to Hartford, Wisconsin. We would stop in Henry, Illinois to harvest asparagus because the frost would thaw out earlier there, and the asparagus shoots would come out. So we would get several weeks of work there before we actually came to Hartford. So that that reference that I make to my mom and my aunts was during the asparagus harvest in Henry, Illinois, and there was no electricity in the labor camp. There was no running water. There was no sewer. So that not only did our parents have to get up early in the morning, get the wood stove going, because of course the kerosene stove just wouldn't heat fast enough for us to eat before going to work, and go out and work all day and then come in and not only cook for us in the before putting us to bed, but then having to wash our clothes. And since there was no hot running water, they built these huge cauldrons of water to boil and then put our clothes in there, and with a stick move them around in the soapy water. In other words, it was nonstop work for them. And I note in my writings how their demeanor started to change. And, you know, at that time, there were no words for the mental conditions of any of us, including the mental conditions of our women. The words for loco, crazy, or loca, you know, for a female just didn't apply. But I started trying to look at their faces and define what was happening to them, and I can't do it because there are just no words. And of course, I was looking for words that we commonly use now as stress, those kinds of mental conditions as such. And I speak about my mother having to suffer an operation, and I going and seeing her in a nearby town of Peoria, and you know those flimsy nightgowns that they put on patients. I just couldn't stand to look at my mother.
Yeah.
So very challenging times during our youth at that time, in particular what was happening to our women. And since I work closest to them, that's who I write about.
You could see those changes, yes. Wisconsin activist and historian Jesus Salas has a memoir. It's called Obreros Unidos, The Roots and Legacy of the Farm Workers Movement. You can be part of the conversation about migrant worker rights. Call in with a question. Share your perspective at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dive into the history of the independent agricultural labor union, Obreros Unidos, or Workers United, operated in Wisconsin starting in the late 1960s, and how this early push for better living and working conditions for migrant farm workers is viewed today. Labor leader Jesus Salas has a memoir about this time, and you can join in with a question or share comments, 800-642-1234. Jesus, in 1966, you organized this 80-mile protest march from Wautoma to Madison, and you give credit to the farm worker march by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta as inspiration. What issues were you marching about in Wisconsin at the time?
Well, I didn't go directly from being a farm worker to being a farm worker organizer of a union. The venue for resettlement in Wisconsin was my father acquiring a small six-table cafe in downtown Wautoma, where it was the center of the migrant workers. And as I was working on tables, some individuals from Madison came over and wanted to know if I was one of the Salas who had been a farm worker and if I would take them to the labor camps, because they were organizing a demonstration program for migrant children. And for the next 3 years, I returned to the labor camps, establishing migrant centers. And over 3 years, we established seven centers serving over 100 children. But it was going back to those labor camps, and I viewed the migrant condition completely different than when I was a part of it. Parents started telling me about their wages. I started seeing the housing condition on a broader basis, the unsanitary conditions, migrants complaining. And as I was in Madison in 1965 doing a report on the migrant workers, somebody brought a newspaper from L.A. says, hey, look what the migrant workers are doing in California. And it was Huerta and Chavez leading a march from Delano to Sacramento in protest of the lack of recognition by the grape growers in the grape strike that they had enjoined that year. And so I said, that's what we need to do, just like Chavez is doing in California. So I got on the phone, and at that time, you know, I like to tell my friends, and they just get amazed, that they were actual operators at the time. in the telephone system, and you could make a person-to-person call, and if they didn't find that person, you didn't have to pay for the call. So I called Delano, California, Cesar Chavez, person-to-person call, and they found him. And I told him who it was, and I'd been a migrant worker and gone back to the labor camps and what I had done with the migrant programs, but that I wanted to do what he had done. And if we could use his the Thunderbird symbol, the flag of the National Farm Workers Association, because I wanted to organize a march. And he said that I could, and he asked me if I would support the grape boycott. So there started the relationship for the next 5 years, where you know, he mentors me in terms of initiating the labor organization, and he asked me to support him in the Great Boycott. Because at the time, farm workers did not have any rights to organize. They if they wanted to have a representation in the union, they were just fired. When the Labor Act was signed in 1935, the Wagner Act, agricultural workers were excluded. But here in Wisconsin, the state and our forefathers here in Wisconsin established a labor law that covered migrant workers. So the 5 years that we organized farm workers, we were under the purview of the Wisconsin Labor Board. So extraordinary situation of Wisconsin farm workers being able to organize and protected by the law, which Chavez couldn't do in California, because we were only of the two states, Wisconsin and Hawaii, who were protected by the labor law.
Jesus Salas with us, labor organizer, author of the memoir Obreros Unidos. Let's take a call now. Mark in Dodgeville. Mark, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
Hello. Oh, yes, I was a friend of Francisco Rodriguez, who Jesus would certainly recognize. For many years, we owned hunting land together here in Wisconsin, and I got the chance to hear all kinds of stories from the old days. The early movement in Texas, La Raza Unida, which means the race united, was bringing people together to vote and run, and Francisco was the first city manager in Crystal City who was not white. There were 90% Hispanic, 10% white, and the white folks, us white folks, ran everything. So he was part of changing that. Then he came to Wisconsin, as Jesus has talked about quite a bit, and settled in here and did a lot to help other migrants come into the area. When he worked for Governor Tony Earle, he was the first Hispanic desk operator contact for the Hispanic community. And he got a law passed through the governor so that anybody going to school in Wisconsin who was a child of migrant laborers or came as a migrant himself or herself could get in-state tuition.
And Mark, how do you think this work, these efforts, have changed Wisconsin, your home?
Well, it's changed in some ways that many Hispanic people and other people, among and others, can come into the state and be more welcomed. And it has failed to change to some extent because there still is a lot of negative feeling among us white people, mostly about other people with accents, with skin colors that are different than ours. So it's been somewhat successful. It's been somewhat unsuccessful. I had hoped when I was younger that racism would die out during my generation. I'm afraid that hasn't happened. But I think that Jesus and Francisco and a number of others have at least brought it part way to where it's not as rampant as it used to be.
Mark, thank you for calling in. Jesus, go ahead. What comes up for you?
Well, the first thing that comes up is that my relationship to the gentleman that he mentioned, that is Francisco Rodriguez. We were both fellow farm workers here in Crystal City. We only lived blocks from each other. His father was a barber and a dear friend of my father, as was his mother with relationship with my mother. The important thing, I think, in addition to the contribution that Francisco and other migrant workers of that generation made, was Mark's reference to Francisco going back to Texas and helping the Mexican-American political movement down there. Or that is what Mark is referring to, is that not only is this a transnational movement, or that is the Chavez energizing the farm workers movement here in California, in Texas, et cetera, but it's a transnational one, or that is the farm workers that organized here in Wisconsin went back since they were seasonal, and initiated political activities. And in our hometown, Francisco actually goes back and becomes the first city manager after cutting his teeth here in Obreros Unidos, or that is, in the farm workers movement. Great story. I'm glad that Mark brought that up, because it's a unique story in that these individuals are getting involved in the union here or going back to Texas and going back to Crystal City and getting the vote out and doing other organizing activities that enhance their political status of their respective communities.
And that is labor leader Jesus Salas, who is sharing an inside look at the farm workers movement in Wisconsin and in Texas, his memoir called Obreros Unidos. Be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question. You can add your perspective along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And we heard from Buzz, who emailed to say that they hoed beets for years in the Red River Valley in North Dakota, said it was hard work, and now the harvest of beets is all mechanical. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Labor leader Jesus Salas writes about the hardship of migrant workers and early efforts to organize. Salas's parents were drawn to Wisconsin's fertile fields for cultivating sugar beets and picking cucumbers and tomatoes by hand. His memoir is called Obreros Unidos, or Workers United. It's the labor union he co-founded in the 1960s. Call in with a question. Share thoughts in this discussion. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jesus, take us to the Libby's walkout in 1967. You organize a migrant farm workers walkout against the large food processor. What was your goal for this walkout?
Well, we had the protest march that we initiated in 1966 was a demand for enforcement of Wisconsin progressive legislation, minimum wage, housing codes, workman's compensation, et cetera. That fall, we went out on strike against a potato processor and completely inexperienced in terms of organizing a farm workers union. But we learned the hard way. And there are two things that happened. The other one was John Schmidt, the president of was elected president of the AFL-CIO, provided us with legal assistance so that we actually had a very concrete idea as to how to organize the union. And the organization the following year in 1967 against Libby's, we were represented by the lawyers who actually represented the state AFL-CIO and guided us through the process. We asked for an emergency certification election. We went out on walkout, but unlike the previous year in the potato processing, we call it a walkout because we went right back in. We didn't want the workers to be prejudiced or to suffer any consequences for walking out. We went to work the next day, but we brought attention to the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission to call an emergency certification election, an emergency because of the perishable nature of the cucumbers. And Libby was the biggest employer in central Wisconsin. Of the 5,000 workers, they employed over 700. So we wanted to go right to the top. Some individuals criticized me and said you should have started with some of the smaller processors and establish your ground game there instead of going after the multinationals. But we went after Libby's. We got the certification election, and we won the election 405-8. Or that almost a unanimous voting by the farm workers that they wanted Obreros Unidos to represent them. And we got ready to negotiate the first contract for the labor union here in the Midwest. And we met, and when we met with the Libby negotiators, they handed us a letter saying that they were pulling all their operations out of the state of Wisconsin and moving them to the Carolinas. And
where there wasn't that type of unionization going on.
Well, we sued them and petitioned the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission to respond to our petition, because we said that they were moving their operations to avoid the union, and they said they were moving their operations just for a bottom line, because they thought that they could harvest the cucumbers cheaper in the Carolinas than they could here. Well, the case held up our organizational activities in the field. So the following year, Libby had three processing plants, the largest one in Hartford. So the following years, we said, all right, so you don't want to recognize our union in the fields, we'll organize your processing plants. So we organized three walkouts in their three processing plants. And again, to no avail. And that's when Chavez tells us, look, Jesus, if you help me, this is a crucial year. This is now the fifth year going into the boycott. If you help me win in the boycott in California, once we win in California, I'll help you win in Wisconsin. Well, I don't know why I believed them, but I believed them. I didn't know it was going to take another a couple of years to win the great boycott. But I moved to Milwaukee to organize the great boycott. And at that time, Wisconsin was crucial, because not only did we consume large quantities of grapes, we consume more brandy than anybody per capita in the state of Wisconsin, if you can believe it, Kate. So here I go to Wisconsin, and what's going on to Milwaukee? What's going on? Father Grappi and the commandos have been 200 consecutive days marching for open housing, and there the farm workers and the Black civil rights movement intersect, because I am hosted at 524 West National. They provide offices, the Archdiocese funded program there. Three blocks down the street, Father Grappi's marching from the north side to picket Ellen Bradley, at that time now Rockwell Standard, because of the 6,000 workers. There's only a handful of Blacks and Latinos. So,
Jesus, what stands out to you from working with Father James Grappi, the Catholic priest, the noted civil rights leader, and in supporting the civil rights movement? What did you learn from Father Grappi?
Well, the I had met Lloyd Barbie before, and I knew that he was suing the Milwaukee public school system for the desegregation of the Milwaukee public schools. So I was involved with that, and eventually petitioned in the lawsuit that bilingual faculty and eventually the bilingual program would be started. With Father Grappi, one of the most extraordinary things, and one of the things that I bring in the book, because as I was reading about Father Grappi, there was just such a negative view of his efforts. Then I talk about his personality, about how gregarious he was, how lighthearted he was. So the laugh that he had, how he just, enlivened the whole crew. He had joined the picket line at Cole Food Store when we were picketing over there on Capitol Drive. So we started working together. We marched together to Madison to the when the welfare marches during the welfare cuts were going on at that time, and we got removed by the National Guard. He eventually, the legislature sued him and enjoined him for the march.
Can we pause right there, because I wonder, yeah, how did the Welfare Mothers March on Madison, and as you talk about the Milwaukee Open Housing Marches, how did that intersect with the work to advance migrant worker rights in
The 524 West National in Milwaukee is only several blocks where the United Migrant Opportunity Services grant program had been funded. Mm-hmm. And so I would walk over there, just as I had walked over three blocks to meet Grappi, to the United Migrant Opportunity Service. And they were teed off in that all of the Anglos, all of the administrators were Anglos, and all the field workers were Mexican, and the mission statement was the poor should help themselves, if you recall. That was the whole mantra of the war on poverty. And here there were no migrant workers on the board. So I started getting involved with the migrant worker program in addition to working with Father Grappi. And one of the things that the way these things conjoin is that in the resettlement program, the state of Wisconsin administered to the county of Milwaukee would assist resettling immigrant workers, and so that UMass depended on the resettlement programs of the efforts for migrant workers who were being displaced by automation, and the support by the county of Milwaukee as the welfare funds were being provided, so that the cutting of the welfare funds affected the resettlement programs of former migrant workers who were being displaced, and that's how I got involved, how I joined the effort for the welfare marches, because it was impacting on our resettlement and retraining of former migrant workers in Milwaukee and Wisconsin.
When you cut ties with Cesar Chavez in California, there were tensions that arose between the two of you, and you eventually stopped coordinating with the grape boycott. Why did you two disagree?
Because he wanted me to focus completely on the grape boycott. And here I was getting involved with the civil rights movement and helping out the workers in United Migrant Opportunity Services in the wintertime. Like Mark mentioned, our organizers were going back, former migrant workers were going back home in Texas and getting involved in political activities, and I'd go down there with them. I spent my winters down there organizing. We could never organize the Libby's 700 workers in a 6-7 weeks period of time. So I would organize migrants in the wintertime down there. So I continued to do that. And Chavez didn't like that. He said, you said you were going to help me with a great boycott. What are you doing, you know, organizing and getting involved in political activities in your hometown in Texas? So that's where the tension began. But it was an amicable kind of a breakup. I just couldn't give up the activities that were going on from my homies in South Central Texas, former migrant workers like myself, and their activities with Grappi and the United Migrant Opportunity Services in Milwaukee. And so that's when we started breaking up. And I said, Chavez, this is as far as I'm going to go with a great boycott. I'll continue on a part-time basis, and we did. I continued working on the Great Boycott until 1970, when we won the first contract, but not traveling like on his behalf, where I would go to Philadelphia, I would go to Chicago, I would go, you know, travel all over pursuing the Great Boycott. I stayed pretty much between Texas and Wisconsin.
Jesus Salas's memoir, it's called Obreros Unidos, The Roots and Legacy of the Farm Workers Movement, as we discuss migrant worker activism in Wisconsin through generations. Call in with a question. Share what's on your mind, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore efforts to organize migrant farm workers in central Wisconsin in the 1960s and how an independent union called Obreros Unidos, or Workers United, it laid a foundation for migrant worker rights into the future. Jesus Salas co-founded Obreros Unidos and reflects on this era in a memoir. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jesus, you enrolled at UW-Milwaukee, and you write that there were several barriers to increasing Latino enrollment at the time. What were those challenges like?
Well, while we were migrant workers, everywhere that we went, my father always placed us in school. And As I note, I graduated from Henry, Illinois, grade mm-hmm. school, my eighth grade. And my freshman year in high school, I went to three different high schools in three different states. So while I was organizing, I attempted to stay in school, just as my father was very anxious that I stay in college. So it took me 10 years, but I finally ended up here in Milwaukee. In 1968, when I came to organize a Great Boycott, I enrolled at UWM, and out of 25,000 students, as I note in my book, all of us could sit around one table. All the Latinos could sit around one table. And what became the urgency of the enrollment was not simply that that we were being denied access, but when we got involved with UMOS and we started insisting that all the social service agencies actually have the poor, or that is the people that they serve, in their board, and that there be hiring of Latinos in those social service and educational programs, UWM became essential for the enhancement of their contribution to those agencies, and in fact to the community at large, so that we started to petition the chancellor's office not only to access school for Latinos, but to establish a Spanish-speaking outreach institute that would guide Latinos into financial aid, academic support, et cetera, et cetera.
And what was the resistance like? What went on there?
The resistance wasn't so much that the doors we're going to remain closed. We eventually were going to knock them down. But the fact is, we wanted a program. We mm-hmm. thought that there was an essential need to create a counseling academic support program to guide the students. You know, at that time, you know, we need to say how segregated the community was. The UWM was on the other side of the planet. There were no communications between Latinos in the near south side, blacks in the north side, and the people who lived in the UWM area. And we wanted to get the Latinos and African Americans to start crossing those viaduct bridges and to start enrolling and participating in the classes that were being offered at UWM. So it was an effort that required us to engage and apply, and we started enrolling the students and demanding the program. And of course, they wouldn't give it to us, so we had to. One of the things that I learned from Father Grappi was direct action. And we never, the 4 years that I had been involved in the child care programs, 4 years that I had been involved in the union, I had never been in jail. But then when I started organizing here in Milwaukee, I couldn't stay out of jail. We were arrested at the Kohl's food store. We were arrested at UWM. We were arrested in our march for the welfare protest. So,
and you had to be strategic about these arrests and how bail would be posted. What was your approach?
Because the first time I didn't know that if you got arrested on Friday, there was no courts on the weekend. So we just sat around waiting for the judges to show up on Monday. Mm. Dumb, right? So we never got arrested again. Every time we went on manifestation, we made sure that there was bail money, that there was attorneys available to represent us, et cetera. Yes, of course, we learned the hard way.
Jesus Salas with us, labor organizer, author of Obreros Unidos. Let's bring in Carla in Stevens Point. Hi, Carla.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
I would just like to bring up that I love your program today. I heard it just by accident, and it reminds me of my childhood. I lived in rural Portage County, small town. We had quite a few migrant workers in the day that would come up. This was back in the 50s and 60s, and they lived in difficult conditions. From my perspective as a kid, I could see that. And sometimes in the winters, they couldn't get back to the area in Texas where they had come from, and they would be stuck in our winters here, and with no schooling, the Wisconsin school system or whatever decided, public schools decided that they would have a room, almost like a one-room schoolhouse environment, where they would educate these children. And my mom was hired to be their teacher. She had taught in one-room school, so she knew how to organize that kind of thing. And she was so good. And when I watched her and her close association with the public health department, at that time it was Ruth Gilfrey, a great public health nurse here, I learned so much from those two women and how they approached trying to help people without being suspicious of them or backgrounds or anything. Just help to promote public education and public health. That lesson stuck with me my whole life.
Oh,
and
Carla,
a lot of them.
Thank you for sharing that story of the rural Portage County in that era. Jesus, go ahead.
Yes, so we were talking about the establishment of the Spanish-Speaking Outreach Institute. The enrollment of UWM, I said, wasn't that the chancellor was resisting the access, but it was resisting establishing a program to support those students, encourage them, assist them in financial aid, provide, if necessary, the tutorials that they needed to survive. And we enrolled the students ourselves. We actually did a lot of work ourselves, but the success of the social services programs in the near south side, including at United Migrant Opportunity Services, and now the wealth of services that we provide is a part of the success story that we established back then, where we enrolled hundreds of these students, and right now there is a network. We have the UMAS, we have the clinic, we have the just go down the line, and all the United Community Center.
And Jesus, we're almost out of time, less than a minute to go. But Andy in Manitowoc called in and wants to know whether the large number of migrants trying to enter the U.S. over the southern border, is that affecting the migrant labor movement today?
The back when we were migrant workers, over 100,000 migrants are coming to the Midwest, over 15,000 to Wisconsin. Presently, there's a little less than 5,000 migrant workers that come up, mostly male workers working in the food processing and meat packing, et cetera. There is not as much a field work as there used to be when I was working as a migrant, but there's still a great need for field work for migrant workers, especially in the processing plants. There is a cry for additional workers all over the place, and including the working conditions in some of the processing plants and meat packing. You hear about the working conditions. I think that we need to look at those further as these people join that workforce.
Jesus, thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you very much, Kate, for having me.
Jesus Salas, author of Obreros Unidos, The Roots and Legacy of the Farm Workers Movement. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore Midwestern foodways cultivated by immigrant communities over generations in Wisconsin and our neighboring states. You can call in about Midwestern cuisine, past, present, future. The number to join in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul Fehrbach is a Chicago-based chef and author of Midwestern Food, A Chef's Guide to the Surprising History of a Great American Cuisine with more than 100 tasty recipes. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Good morning to you, and thanks for having me.
Good morning, and I want to say your ranch dressing from this book is an absolute game changer in our household, so thank you for that.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you got to try it already.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Add a little more dill, a little more onion flakes, and we're good to go. So, you know, I mean, you call the Midwest the most consequential region in the development of American food and drink culture. What makes us a bastion of American cuisine?
A lot of it has to do with our history as the breadbasket. You have the grain belt, the production of wheat, and the mills in Minneapolis that have provided flour coast to coast for well more than a century now, a century and a half, as well as the meatpacking industry, which grew up in Chicago, but was also important in towns like St. Louis and Kansas City. And we've shipped meat all over the world, and things like hamburgers and hot dogs, which are considered quintessentially American, actually came out of this industry in the middle of the country.
I thought it was interesting too. I mean, you mentioned the mills in Minneapolis, but you say like Betty Crocker is someone that we should, Betty Crocker cookbooks, we should, are essential for understanding Midwestern food. What do you see there?
Yeah, Midwestern food, but also really American food as a whole, because she had millions of listeners all across the country for her radio show. But she was such an influential author. I mean, my mom cooked out of Big Red, which is what her first cookbook from 1955 is often called, the Betty Crocker Picture Cookbook. My mom cooked out of it all the time, well into the 80s. And people all across the country were. So a lot of dishes that became popular in mid-20th century America, or that were popular in mid-20th century America, were influenced heavily by Betty Crocker, as well as our baking arts like cakes and cookies. They really taught people how to use General Mills products, Ashburn Washbury, this mill company that today is General Mills. They wanted people to learn how to use their products, and they made wheat flour, you know, one of the most important foods in our homes. So extremely important. And really what they were trying to do was sell flour.
What is your criteria for how you included a recipe in this book? How did these recipes get in here?
Well, I think it's important to understand immigrant cuisine versus, you know, say American cuisine in our instance, or Midwestern cuisine, in that immigrants come and they cook dishes that come from their home countries or from their home territories. And they either stay in the instance of something like fried chicken, or they evolve and change. And pizza-like foods, pizza came from Italy, from both Sicily and the southern part of the boot, but it changed and it evolved here in very novel ways. So the way I looked at it to say something was Midwestern or an immigrant cuisine was to say, well, if in the event of an immigrant dish, did it exist here for 90 years or three generations, which is to say the first generation brought it, or the immigrants brought it, the first generation kept it, and their children were still, they were still cooking it for their children. Their children were still enjoying it more or less intact. And I think fried chicken is a classic example of that. Bratwurst are another example of that. But then there's also the case of foods that evolved here in unique ways, which pizza is my favorite example to use of that, because you know, here in the Midwest, certainly in Wisconsin, you have tavern style pizza. We have it here in Chicago also. In Detroit, you have Detroit style pizza. In St. Louis, you have St. Louis style pizza. And there's, you won't find anything like any of these in Italy, although the inspiration for cooking different ingredients on a flat disc of dough certainly did come from Italy. So it's Italian in heritage, but they're distinctively Midwestern dishes. So pizza's only been here really since post-World War II in most places. Chicago and Detroit had pizza as early as the 1920s, but they had older Italian communities. But the rest of the Midwest was really the late 1940s, 1950s was when we started cooking pizza. So it hasn't been around that long, actually, which is hard to believe.
It is, because it's so ingrained in our meals on weeknights. Paul Fehrbach with us as we talk about Midwestern food, author and chef. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Heard from Sarah in Libertyville, Illinois, called and said that they loved the Betty Crocker cookbook as a kid, and their family used it all the time, but only made the baking recipes, so things like muffins and cookies and pies and cakes, and the cookbook was covered in dough and flour, and said that as they got older, they cut the sugar in half and these recipes were much better. What do you make of that sentiment?
That's actually a really good question, but again, they were trying to use products, they were trying to promote products that people would buy on the grocery store shelves. And I think back then, and certainly if you read a lot of the old community cookbooks around the Midwest, which is sort of what was inspiring a lot of Betty Crocker's writing, because her team in their offices at General Mills that would develop these recipes, they were women who cooked in homes in the Midwest. And they had Midwesterners have always had a huge sweet tooth. So a lot of these recipes, they're toothache sweet. And I find this myself when I develop recipes for my restaurant today, that it's almost always, you can cut the sugar in half and it's going to be great, because you're going to push those sweet buttons on your tongue a little bit less. And a lot of the other flavors come forward, which, especially if you're making something like pie, almost any kind of pie, you want to taste the fruit. You don't want to just have sugar taking over everything. So I would definitely agree with that sentiment. And I think it's just because of the sweet tooth that people had back in the 1940s and 50s.
So you say there's a difference between a recipe and a receipt. Can you explain the distinction between the two?
Yeah, so a receipt, the simplest way to think about it is maybe a set of instructions or a method that your grandma would write down that didn't have any measurements in it or very vague measurements in it, to say a teacup of this or a spoon of that, because she wouldn't really need to refer to a specific measurement, because she probably had a spoon that she always used when she cooked to measure things. Or maybe she didn't even measure things.
She was doing it by rote memory.
Yeah, so that would be a receipt, whereas a recipe was a concept that developed by the Boston Cooking School in the 1880s, where you would actually have very specific, you know, quote unquote, scientific measurements for ingredients and very specific recommendations for, like, a receipt might say, bake in a quick oven until brown, whereas a recipe would say, you know, bake in a 350 degree oven and for, you know, 45 minutes until a toothpick inserted in comes out clean.
Paul Fehrbach, Chicago-based chef, author of the new book Midwestern Food, as we dig into modern Midwestern foodways that evolve as people from different cultures settled here over centuries. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's foods through which we here in Wisconsin and all over the Midwest have found identity captured in historical recipes. Chef Paul Fehrbach read old community cookbooks to trace the origins of recipes. His book is called Midwestern Food. And you can be part of this food conversation. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul, Wisconsin tailgate staple is the beer brat, and you claim your recipe may be the best sausage out there. What makes it special?
I've actually never seen a sausage cooked this way, and I think it's a really clever technique, but it was the way my dad cooked beer brats. And I, you know, he says it's the way his dad showed him how to cook beer brats. And you basically put the bratwurst in a, you have to have a heavy iron skillet, 10 or 12 inches. And say so you have to have two beers to do this. You have to have one for the bratwurst and you have to have one to cook the bratwurst, because if you do it right, it takes you about as long to cook the bratwurst as it does to drink the beer.
Yeah.
You, you have to start with really good bratwurst. And the best thing about, one of the best things about Wisconsin is that you have great bratwurst, because in almost every town, you have a great local butcher. Mm-hmm. And so you have to use really good bratwurst from a really good local butcher, because the skin is really important, that casing. So you put the bratwurst in a heavy iron skillet, and you work mostly over medium low heat. You start on kind of high heat because there's a lot of liquid, and you gradually turn it down as the beer boils away. But you cover the bratwurst with one of the beers, and then you poach it in this beer, but you cook the beer completely out. So you start on high heat and constantly turning the bratwurst, and so that they cook evenly, because that's really important so that they don't split or pop or anything like that, because you want that casing intact. So you keep turning the bratwurst every 15 seconds or so. And as this beer starts to sort of run down and becomes like lower than halfway up the bratwurst, you start to turn the heat down a little bit, because it's going to get pretty hot. And eventually, you know, you start turning the bratwurst a little more often, and then they're going to start to brown as that beer disappears. And that beer is going to turn into a syrup, which caramelizes on the exterior of the bratwurst and gets really, really crispy and almost charred. So you have to be turning them constantly to keep the beer coating on them. And as it sort of turns into caramel and then chars a little bit, and then you have to wait a while to eat them, because once they're done, they're really crispy on the outside and really hot. But if they pop, and everybody who's had bratwurst knows that a bratwurst can pop, and you got to watch out for that juice. These have really hot molten juice, so you got to let them rest for about 5 or 10 minutes before you eat them. But they're crunchy on the outside and succulent and juicy on the inside and redolent of beer. It's just my favorite way to eat bratwurst.
Oh, it's so, you know, letting that bratwurst rest after you take it out of the pan, that really will test your patience. You know, and we have a link to your beer brat recipe on our program page over at WPR.org/mornings. You can find it there. You mentioned your dad teaching you how to make beer brats. How does food and cooking play into family relationships in your German heritage?
They were really important. I mean, everything from community. Think of the opening of the barbecue chapter. I talk about, we called them pig roasts. We didn't, in the Midwest, they weren't called barbecues, at least not back in the day, where everyone gathered around a pig rotating on a spit. Two things like my dad showing me how to make a bratwurst. Mom made this dessert called Cherry Delight. The recipe's in the book, and people should absolutely make that recipe. It's fabulous.
With Michigan cherries.
or
Door County.
You got some pretty good cherries up there in Door County last
Equal
I checked.
Equal opportunity there.
Yeah. So, I mean, all of these things are, the family just sort of obviously is part of everyday life, and food is part of everyday life. And so recipes become something that sort of ties the web of life together. And that includes family and friends and community.
We're talking about Midwestern food with author and chef Paul Fehrebach. And you can join in along the way. Call in with a question. Share your comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I just felt such kinship with you, Paul, as you went down into your grandmother's cellar and saw so many lines of pickled things and other things just lining shelves. I have German heritage as well. My mom from a family of 13, and you know, it just felt so cool how you really dug into your family's recipes and the roots to really understand how they were affecting food culture. What was the aha moment there for you?
I mean, I think the aha moment was years ago when my brother, Brett, my older brother, Brett, he's a year older than me, and dad were sitting out on the porch one summer and just talking about life on the farm where dad grew up. And grandma had a huge kitchen garden and canned all of these things. And grandpa had a smokehouse. He was a tomato farmer by trade. He sold into the Red Gold Co-op. That was how they got their cash money. But he was started talking about the wine, the wild cherry and blackberry wine that grandpa would make. And it really lit up a light bulb in my head, because it was something that I remembered seeing on those wooden ricks in the basement when I was a kid. This wine, and grandpa would, it turns out, make it in huge quantities. He made it in a whiskey barrel. And I just thought to myself, wow, I've really got to, you know, tell me that again, Dad, and let me turn on the recorder on my phone and start recording and remembering these things.
You dedicate this book to the women of the greater Midwest. Why is that?
Because I think, and you know, probably all women would know this, and hopefully increasingly more men know that women have always kind of had a thankless role in society that people just take for granted. Certainly in the culture I grew up in, mom worked incredibly hard, and both of my grandmas worked incredibly hard taking care of their families. Everything from, you know, showing the kids how to tie their shoes, to making sure dinner was on the table, to making sure everybody was on, dressed properly and on time for school. Really keeping the family together while, you know, and again, this is in sort of the old line traditional American culture that dad went off and earned the paycheck and mom stayed home and made sure the pulse of the home was running correctly. And I think that women just haven't really been thanked for that incredibly important role that they've played. I mean, everyone loves their mom. Hopefully everyone loves their mom. But I think that really a recognition of how important their work is in food, particularly in the case of this book, but in our culture, is it's hard to overstate. And I don't think that it's been stated enough how important women's role is.
The modern populations of Wisconsin and other Midwestern states, predominantly white. How are people of color affecting food in the Midwest?
Historically, mostly in the cities. And I think in Chicago and St. Louis, we have barbecue culture. There's some barbecue culture in Minneapolis and Detroit and Milwaukee as well. The cities tend to be where immigrants go and settle, you know. So right now we have a lot of Korean immigrants. We've had Chinese immigrants for a few generations now, Mexican immigrants that come in and sort of tinker with our food ways, sort of tinker with the things that are here, like the Italians did. The Germans were sort of part of the first wave when the cities were coming. So a lot of our food ways were, the foundations of them were on German cuisine, but the Italians came in and Mexican and Latino immigrants come in and sort of start tinkering with the food ways. And they don't really percolate out into the country until quite a bit later. I mean, I sort of experienced this growing up where, you know, these nationwide trends wouldn't make it to our small town until, you know, 10 or in some cases 20 years later.
Took some time, yes. Chef Paul Fehrbach, author of Midwestern Food, paying tribute to our cuisine in the heartland and the influences of German ancestry, immigrants in dishes and drinks. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your insights along the way. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're in conversation with Chicago chef Paul Fehrabach, who aims to give more credit to Midwestern food. I mean, come on. His new book captures recipes in their original form, and Paul studies the influences of immigrant communities and foods and how they inform what we cook up today in Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Kathy in Maquanago. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I was telling the other young lady that when I grew up in Chippewa County in northern Wisconsin, German French heritage, and when we butchered a pig, my grandmother would take the head of the pig and put it in a big pot and boil it and for hours, and she would then make head cheese. And it was kind of solid. It was gray looking, but it was solid. Now I noticed in the store when you want to buy head cheese, it's got all this gelatin in it, which makes it unappetizing. But we loved it, and we had a conversation here in town about it, and everybody made faces about it. But it was good food back then.
Kathy, thank you for that remembrance. Paul, go ahead.
I love head cheese, and she's absolutely right that the supermarket version of it is kind of odd and doesn't really resemble what we would know in home cooking. And my grandma would make head cheese from the head of the pig when grandpa would do the hog killings, and the men would make the sausages and all of that. Everybody had their role. But when I started seeing head cheese in grocery stores, it's like these little bits of snout and ear and all of that suspended in this clear aspic or gelatin. And it never looked appetizing to me, but apparently somebody's buying it because they continue to sell it in the store. I like the traditional one where it's just kind of boiled and eventually, yeah, it's kind of gray, but it's really rich. If you like the taste of pork, it's as porky as it gets.
Not quite the transition, but you do have the recipe for cold packed cheese or squeezed cheese. What's the story behind that?
There was a lot of legends about where cold packed cheese came from. And because it can be a little bit murky, a lot of these stories, but I did eventually find a reference to the Scandinavian practice of preserving bits and pieces of cheese in either aquavit or beer by blending it all together. So, you know, you have little scraps of cheese left over and you want to preserve it. So you add a little alcohol and beat it until it's all in there. And so that would sort of dovetail on the timeline of when Scandinavian immigrants started to come to Wisconsin in the 1890s or so, and in the early 1900s is when crock cheese appears, and Pine River Dairy, I think, was the first to make a brand for the market. And Kokan, I think, was the original brand. They work out of Pine River Dairy. They're twin labels. It's, you know, I grew up with it. I absolutely love it. A lot of people think it's weird because it's cheese you can spread. But if you know what cold packed cheese is, it's just two or more cheeses that are blended together without heat. So it's cheese, but you can spread it. I mean, I can't think of anything better.
Turning to beer, because over the last decade, the microbrewery scene in America has just boomed. And in 2020, the Brewers Association says there were over 2,500 craft breweries throughout the Midwest. Why are craft beers a popular drink in the Midwest?
Well, I mean, I think there is a lot of German heritage here. For one, Irish, Polish, Scandinavian, all of these cultures like drinking beer. And so it's natural for people to want a different taste. When I was growing up, there were a handful of beer brands that you could find in the grocery store, you know, as of the 1970s, because all of the breweries that did exist before Prohibition, most of them most of them stopped existing during Prohibition. So there used to be a lot of breweries around town. My hometown of Jasper, Indiana had three breweries on the cusp of Prohibition and didn't have another one until the 1990s when somebody decided to start brewing beer and, you know, started a little brew house. And that's sort of the movement. It's sort of a reclamation, I think, of that heritage of having a brewery in your town. And so you also get a lot more different flavors and types of beer that way. And people like variety. And I think that that has a lot to do with what's fueling it.
And toward the beginning of the 1900s, your research says fewer home brewing beer recipes were appearing in cookbooks. And you attribute that trend to the rise in commercial breweries. What kinds of things were coming out of cookbooks? What kind of beer were people brewing at home?
Oh, there were some really wild recipes in the 19th century. I mean, one of them was nothing but molasses and hops boiled together and then fermented. Lettuce Bryan in this cookbook called the Kentucky Housewife, which was actually published in Cincinnati. But with the westward migration of people during the 19th century, it was a really important book in the Midwest as well. She has recipes for London Porter in there. She has recipes for India Pale Ale. And some of these recipes would be extremely elaborate. You think nowadays, you think of beer as being malt and hops and yeast, and then you ferment it and then you have beer. But a lot of these would have, you know, yeah, molasses was a common ingredient, different spices. Some of them would have, you know, medicinal things added to it. Just a really wild variety. The one thing you never saw in these home cookbooks, though, was recipes for lager beers, which are what would eventually become the commercial standard. And because lager is a difficult thing to brew and you just couldn't do it at home back then.
Paul Fehrbach, as we talk about Midwestern food, author and chef, you can join in the conversation. The number to call is 800-642-1234 to ask a question, share your comments about Midwestern cuisine. Let's go to Paul in Hurley. Paul, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My story is I grew up in Racine, a very German family. And I just had my mother and three sisters up here visiting, and we decided to make a family recipe, potato pancakes. And my father showed me how to do that. It's grated potatoes with some bread added, no egg, no flours added. And one of the secrets is to mix it for like 10 minutes to get the consistency correct. And it turned out wonderfully. I hadn't made it in like 5 years, but I was real happy with the result again.
How did you dress the potato pancakes?
Oh, living in Hurley, I have access to maple trees. So homemade maple syrup, fresh applesauce from apples picked that same day. It was wonderful.
Oh, wow, that is so fabulous. Oh, Paul from Hurley, thank you so much. Paul Fehrbach, what do you make of the potato pancakes?
That sounds fantastic. And it there's great apples in Wisconsin now, too. So good call there. Potato pancakes are really important in Wisconsin. And actually, in the fish fry culture, you see potato pancakes pop up a lot. Whereas almost everywhere else, you know, fried fish nowadays, they serve with French fries. It's a very sort of rote or standard thing nowadays. But a lot of Wisconsin fish fries will actually advertise that they have potato pancakes because people are looking for these. The recipe that Paul described with broken up bread and mixing it together, that's a really rare kind of recipe and a particularly delicious one because bread brings an extra sort of toasty flavor to it, which that toasty caramelized flavor is one of the things we like about potato pancakes, and bread brings a whole other dimension to that.
I laughed when you wrote that there are probably as many recipes for fried fish as there are cooks in Wisconsin. Why do you think that is?
Because recipes and food are very personal. And, you know, I never liked beer batter. As an adult, I have kind of taken to it a little bit more. I think it was maybe because I wasn't using good beer before or using the wrong kind of beer. If you take an IPA and mix it into a beer batter, all you're going to taste is hops by the time you fry something. I like to use hard cider more than I like to use beer for batters. Some people don't like either and would just use club soda. Some people don't like the sort of the airiness that brings to the batter, so they just use water or milk to make their batter. Some people use eggs because they like the richness. To me, eggs make a batter that doesn't cook as crisp. So, and some people like to dry dredge fish, which for me, it depends on how thick the fillet is. Really thin fish fillets, something like bluegill or younger whitefish or trout, I like to just bread. Whereas thicker fish fillets, cod, larger whitefish, I think are better batter fried, but everybody has their preference. And so in every household, you're going to have a different approach to frying fish.
Chef Paul Fehrbach's book, it's called Midwestern Food, and he studies the archives of recipes, how they evolved through generations, becoming memorable to Wisconsin and the Midwest. Call in at any point with a question. You can share your perspectives and memories, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we talk about Midwestern food, Chicago-based chef Paul Fehrbach, who reads old cookbooks to trace the origin stories of Midwest cuisine and how recipes came to be, join this discussion with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. We have Randy in Ripon now. Hi, Randy.
Well, good morning. I grew up around farming here, and my mom's parents were German, and all the family were farmers. And I just remember the meals with the casseroles or pot roast or pork roast. And then Grandma used to make these raised donuts, like a yeast-raised donut. And I found a place in Madison. Of course, it's no longer there, but the recipe must have been identical to my grandmother's because it was almost sourdough-like. But all these things like German potato salad, I've never found anybody that made German potato salad as good as she did. But to me, that stuff seems exotic now. It's hard to come by.
It's hard to come by in the form that you remember it. Is that right?
Well, in restaurants just don't, I mean, some try, but, you know, everybody wants sushi or whatever, you know, hot and spicy stuff. And, I love that food and I long for it. Just the memories.
Oh, Randy, thank you so much. Paul, you know, from the yeast raised donuts to the German potato salad, it's just hard to find out there in the same way.
Yeah, I definitely sympathize with Randy about all of these foods. And it's, you know, some of that is the inspiration for why I wrote this book. I wanted to write down some of these recipes and document them. Because food waste change, it's true that like now a youngster might experience ramen before they've had, you know, chicken and noodles or chicken and dumplings. And I'm not saying that's bad, but I think we also need to value our food a little bit more, our traditional foods, and cook them a little bit more often. Because I think certainly for me growing up, I took them for granted. And when I grew up, as an adult, I didn't want to eat them as much because I wanted to try new things. But the problem is that if we don't eat them, if we don't eat that traditional German potato salad, or if we don't eat, you know, the hot potato salad, or if we don't make raised yeast donuts at home, you know, those arts get lost. And I wanted to document as many of them as I could in this book, and also encourage people to revisit them and to cook them more often, because they are really delicious.
Let's bring in Carol in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Carol. What's on your mind?
Well, apple dumplings are on my mind. I wonder if he's found that recipe or is familiar with it. My mom was German. I grew up in northwestern Illinois, and apple dumplings was a favorite. So I just was curious if he was familiar with apple dumplings.
Carol, thanks. Paul?
Apple dumplings are actually the first recipe that I learned how to cook. And they didn't make it into the book. Unfortunately, there's such a diversity of foods in the Midwest. We could only include about 100 recipes. In second grade, I actually had a crush on my teacher, Mrs. Bloomy. And she said one day in class that she loved apple dumplings. And so I went home and told Mom that I had to make apple dumplings. And Mom, of course, was, I had just the best mom. And so we went to the store and we got some apples and we made apple dumplings. And the next day I took them to school for Mrs. Bloomy. She was she was quite surprised. But yeah, Mom had made them many times. Mom wasn't of a German background, but she learned them from my dad's mom, who was one of these German American women who she grew up and she never spoke a lick of English in her life because that community was so populated by people from the German state of Baden. Most of the older people there never even learned how to speak English, but she'd learned how to make apple dumplings, and I went home and I had to make apple dumplings, and that was in second grade the first recipe I learned how to make.
Oh, what a memory. Carol, thank you so much for bringing that up. Let's go to Barbara in Grand Marsh. Barbara, hi.
Hello. My mother made the best potato pancakes. Today, when you go to the restaurant, they use shredded potatoes. My mother grated her potatoes and grated the onions. They were thin and lacy on the edges.
Thin and lacy on the edges. Can you replicate them today, Barbara?
I've tried, but I don't know. Maybe I don't know what I'm doing wrong. Maybe it's the kind of potatoes. I don't remember what kind of potatoes she used. And I know there. I didn't think there was any egg in it either.
Paul, any clues?
You might try the recipe that's in the book, which has one or two eggs in it, but you can make them without. There's a Swiss recipe, and I think where a lot of these potato pancake recipes come from is the very, very southwestern part of Germany, Switzerland, Baden, Swabia. You get potato pancakes all over Germany and the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. But there's a particular kind called rosti, which you find, or look for some rosti recipes, which are from Switzerland, you know, the German-speaking part of Switzerland in the very, very southwestern corner of Germany, where it's really basically just shredded potatoes cooked in schmaltz, cooked in hot fat. And then schmaltz in German could be, it could be pork fat, chicken fat, beef fat, any kind of rendered fat. If you're Jewish, it usually means poultry fat. But yeah, I mean, they're fantastic. It's my favorite way to make them, actually, again, is without any egg at all, because just like with beer batter or with a fish batter, the egg, it adds richness, but, and yeah, it can hold your pancake together, but the potatoes have plenty of starch. They don't need the eggs to hold them together, but the eggs can also make it more spongy and soft. And if you really like those lacy, crunchy edges, don't put any egg in it. I would say the one potato you might look for at a farmer's market, if you can, because you're not going to find them at the grocery store, is called a German butterball. It's a starchy potato, okay, similar to a russet, but they're much smaller. And you can grate those, and they make fantastic roasty.
We need to make some space here for the Kringle, Wisconsin's official state pastry. Yearbook, you have a Chicago Hardy fig version, and we have that recipe over at WPR.org/mornings. Can you talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, Kringles, they're obviously Danish in heritage, and I just love them. And I think I didn't get to Racine until maybe 7 or 8 years ago for the first time. And it was one of the towns that sort of made me realize I've got to do this book, because at the time the book was going to be more about the Ohio River Valley's food and my family's food. And I visited Racine, and on the recommendation of a friend, I went to Wells Brothers and got pizza. and I went to Benson's, and I went to O&H, and Benson's has a really good Seven Sisters, which is another traditional Danish pastry as well. But I, you know, loaded up on Kringles, went to Cupie Lunch. I usually wind up having like two lunches when I go to, or three lunches when I go to Racine. And it was one of the towns that made me realize I've got to do this book about the Midwest and not just about, you know, my hometown and about my family, because there's such a great story there. And there's Danish immigrants in different parts of the U.S., and why the Kringle only stuck in Racine is a really good question, but that it's such a delicious pastry that we're lucky to have. And, you know, the Midwest is lucky to have Racine as one of our towns where we can go and get Kringles and absolutely, in my mind, the best tavern style pizza that exists on earth.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, I guess it was, I mean, that's a showstopper there, Paul. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for taking us on this tour. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I had a lot of fun. And thanks to everyone who called in.
Paul Fehrbach, author of Midwestern Food, A Chef's Guide to the Surprising History of a Great American Cuisine, with more than 100 tasty recipes. And there are recipes to check out from the book, including beer brats and that fig Kringle. Find them on our program page at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.